Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I'll be reading from the archives of True West Magazine, March 1989 edition. Death on Horse Creek by Dean Knudsen. In June of 1865, the Civil War had been over for 2 months, and soldiers who had volunteered to fight for the Union were thinking only of their imminent discharge and resuming their civilian lives. The same held true for the officers and men of the 7th Iowa Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, who had been serving on America's western frontier for 2 years, usually in detachments no larger than a company. Lee's surrender at Appomattox left the regiment scattered throughout Kansas, Nebraska, Colorado, Wyoming, and the Dakotas, protecting the overland roads from bushwhackers and marauding Indians. And so it was that with the war over, the Iowa soldiers were ill-prepared for a violent and unexpected fight for their lives along Horse Creek. Company D of the 7th Iowa Cavalry, under the command of Captain William D. Fouts, had arrived on station at Fort Laramie in present-day Wyoming on July 27, 1864, after having already served at Fort Kearney, Nebraska Territory, for nearly 1 year. William Fouts was a former Methodist circuit rider from Indiana. With his second wife, Charity, he had settled into Albia, Iowa in 1857 and entered into business as a merchant. With the coming of the Civil War at age 47, he could have foregone the rigors of military service, but for reasons of his own, he chose to help raise a company of soldiers for a new regiment being organized by Samuel W. Summers of Ottumwa. Fouts was rewarded for his efforts by being elected captain of the newly designated Company D, and he was officially mustered into federal service on April 28, 1863. After completing its training at Camp Hendershot near Davenport, Iowa, the regiment received its orders to march, not toward any of the great battlefields in the east, but west to Nebraska Territory. While stationed at Fort Kearney, Company D logged more than 1,000 miles on escort and scouting details, but neither Captain Fouts nor the men of Company D had the opportunity to gain any actual combat experience against the Plains Indians. This state of affairs ended abruptly on February 4, 1865, when Company D and the units of the 11th Ohio Volunteer Cavalry Regiment responded to appeals for help after Sioux, Cheyenne, and Arapaho warriors attacked and besieged the stage telegraph station at Mud Springs, 105 miles southeast of Fort Laramie. Within 3 hours of receiving the pleading telegram, Lieutenant Colonel William Collins of the 11th Ohio Cavalry and commander of Fort Laramie led 120 troopers on a forced march bound for Mud Springs. An advanced detachment under Collins's personal command was able to push ahead and relieve the station's defenders at 2 a.m. on February 6th. Captain Fouts and the remainder of the column arrived at 8 a.m. that same day. For the rest of the day, the warriors kept the soldiers pinned down around the station. On the morning of the 7th, no Indians were in sight, so Colonel Collins left Fouts in command of the station and personally led a scouting party in search of the Indian camp. The next day, Collins again left Fouts behind at Mud Springs and moved in strength to pursue the Indians. He was able to catch up with them along Rush Creek, and a spirited fight took place, culminating in a mounted charge by between 16 soldiers against an Indian position. Two soldiers were killed in the successful charge. One, 22-year-old Private John A. Harris from Lewis, Iowa, was from Fouts' Company D, 7th Iowa Cavalry. Darkness ended in the fight in a standoff, and dawn brought with it some long-distance skirmishing. The warriors apparently were buying time for their camp to move safely across the frozen North Platte River. By noon, no Indians could be found. Captain Fouts' role in the fight at Mud Springs, while perhaps willing, had been merely supportive in nature, but the men of Company D had served capably under enough during their baptism under fire to earn the praise of Colonel Collins. During this fight, Company D had suffered its first battle casualties. Young Harris had been killed, and two men were wounded. Private Joseph Clark, age 20, from Cheriton, Iowa, was wounded during the fighting at Mud Springs. Private James Allison, 21, from Oskaloosa, Iowa, was wounded at Rush Creek. Both men were able to recover fully and remained with the regiment. After tending to the wounded and repairing the telegraph line, Company D returned to Fort Laramie and resumed its more familiar garrison duties. But the advent of spring and the prospect of an expedition against the tribes to the north posed a new problem for the soldiers at Fort Laramie, where a large number of Indians had gathered around the post. Those friendly tribesmen were increasingly dependent upon government-issued rations that were difficult to transport, and their presence, so close to a key military post, jeopardized secret preparations for a spring campaign. General Greenville Dodge, the new commander of the District of Nebraska, decided the expedient thing to do would be to move these friendlies east to Fort Kearney, where they could be more easily fed and controlled. Thus, in June of 1865, Colonel Thomas Moonlight of the 11th Kansas Volunteer Cavalry Regiment and Colonel Collins's replacement as commander of the Western Subdistrict of Nebraska Territory issued orders to Captain Fouts to take Company D and detachments of Companies A and B of the 7th Iowa Cavalry, a total of 140 officers and men, and escort 185 lodges of the Oglala and Brule Sioux down the Platte River Road to Fort Kearney. This band of Oglala, known as the Laramie Loafers, had been long a fixture around the post, but the Brule, led by Little Thunder and Spotted Tail, had just come into Fort Laramie after having been on the warpath to avenge the Sand Creek Massacre of November 29, 1864. In fact, many of these same Brule warriors had been among those Indians who had attacked Mud Springs. Accompanying the Sioux were an Indian police force led by an Indian trader named Charles Ellison, a wagon train of supplies, four Indian prisoners in chains and leg irons, Mrs. Lucille Eubanks and her infant son, both recently released captives of the Sioux, and the wives and families of Captain Fouts and his first lieutenant, Jeremiah Triggs. On Sunday, June 11, 1865, the escort and wagon left Fort Laramie and marched the 8 miles to Bordeaux Ranch, where the 1,500 Indians were camped. On June 12th, the Indians and escort were able to cover 15 miles before camping at Cold Springs Station. And on the second day of the march, they were able to increase their day's travel to 18 miles before camping at Horse Creek. There, the Indians made their camp on the west bank while the soldiers camped on the east bank. The junction of Horse Creek and the North Platte River had long been a favorite stopping place for travelers in the plains. It had undoubtedly been used by the nomadic tribes for many years before the intrusion of the white man, and in the 1840s, thousands of gold seekers and Mormon immigrants had passed through the area. On September 17, 1851, Horse Creek had been the site chosen for the signing of the first treaty of Fort Laramie, which unsuccessfully tried to end intertribal warfare as well as attacks on wagon trains. In 1860, a Pony Express station, Rittery, apparently combined to create the atmosphere of a death march among the Sioux. That the soldiers saw their mission in a much different light can be seen in Colonel Moonlight's decision to allow the Sioux warriors to keep their weapons during the march to Fort Kearney. As far as the army was concerned, Captain Fouts and his men were simply escorting friendly and willing Indians to a new home. The presence of the officers' wives and families, as well as Mrs. Eubanks, also indicates that the soldiers anticipated no trouble with the Indians. In addition, accounts by the Indians themselves admit that Captain Fouts was considerate enough to allow three of the Indian prisoners to ride government horses to ease the discomfort of their chains. The fourth prisoner rode in a wagon due to a badly swollen ankle. Finally, to further indicate that Captain Fouts was trying to avoid any possibility of a confrontation with the Sioux, there was his extraordinary decision not to issue ammunition to the troopers of Company D, hardly in order to be issued if any hostility was expected. In any event, the Indian camp was becoming increasingly resentful toward the escort, and the leaders among the Sioux made plans for dealing with what they believed was a threat to their safety. At 3 o'clock in the morning of June 14, 1865, reveille was sounded. The order of march was announced at 5 a.m. At sunrise, Captain John Wilcox of Company B led the men of Companies A and B and the wagons down the road. He was to stop after going 2 miles and wait for the Indian camp and the Company D rear guard to close up before resuming the march. After Wilcox and his 70 men had left, it was noticed that the Indians had not yet made an effort to break camp. Captain Fouts and a few of his men crossed Horse Creek to hurry the Indians along. As Fouts approached the Indian leaders, shots rang out and Fouts fell from his saddle with a bullet through his head. One Indian account credits a Brule subchief named White Thunder with killing Fouts, a deed that the warriors considered glorious. Another account holds that Fouts was killed by eager young warriors who thus ruined the planned massacre of Company D. Three other Iowans fell victim to the Sioux that morning, but very little is known about the circumstances surrounding their deaths. In the book Crazy Horse, Strange Man of the Oglala, Mary Sandoz suggests that after Fouts' death, the warriors killed the soldiers guarding the chained Indian prisoners. All other accounts are silent on the subject. All that is known for certain is that the bodies of the following soldiers were found in the Indian camp. Private Philip Alder, age 32, from Waterloo, Iowa, of Company B. Private Richard Groger, 35, from Dahlonega, Iowa, of Company D. And Private Edward McMahon, 36, from Monona, Iowa, of Company D. Because they had no ammunition, the men of Company D fell back toward Captain Wilcox's position, where they reported the mutiny. As the senior surviving officer, Captain Wilcox assumed command. He ordered the wagons corralled and had his men dig rifle pits. He then ordered a messenger to ride the 18 miles to Fort Mitchell for help. Wilcox led half of his men back to the Horse Creek campsite. There, they found the stripped and mutilated bodies of their comrades and learned that the Indians had abandoned their lodges in order to hasten their escape to the north. While pursuing the Indians, Wilcox was attacked by a large force of mounted warriors. The soldiers formed a skirmish line and were able to halt the Indians' charge. But the warriors began to envelop each flank, forcing Wilcox to withdraw to his fixed positions. After their return to the wagons, the soldiers, angered by the treachery of the Indians, shot and killed the luckless prisoner who had been riding in the wagon. Reinforcements in the form of Captain Jacob S. Schumann of Company H, 11th Ohio Cavalry, and 30 of his men arrived at 9 a.m. Another attempt was made to pursue the Indians, but by that time they had crossed the North Platte and formed a group of Sioux warriors from the north who had been shadowing the column. Among these warriors were such prominent men as Red Cloud and Crazy Horse. Facing the high water and the Sioux reinforcements, Captain Wilcox decided against further pursuit. Besides, there were wounded troopers to think about. Private Samuel Kersey, age 20, from Oskaloosa, Iowa, of Company B, was severely wounded. Slightly wounded were Private Lewis Tuttle, age 45, from Lucas County, Iowa, of Company D. Private James May, age 21, from Knoxville, Iowa, of Company D, and Private John Trout, age 23, from Van Buren County, Iowa, of Company D. After burying the dead, tending to the wounded, and burning the Sioux lodges, the soldiers resumed their march and arrived safely at Fort Mitchell that same evening. Thus ended one of the more tragic episodes in America's frontier history. Two very different cultures were competing for the same land, and each failed to see the apparent good intentions of the other. Death and suffering were the result. Hostilities between the U.S. Army and the Sioux would continue for another 25 years. But the men of Company D, 7th Iowa Volunteer Cavalry Regiment, were required to serve only another 10 months on the plains, as they were officially mustered out of the federal service at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas Territory, on May 17th, 1866. True West Magazine Archives, March 1989 edition. Half Man, Half Woman, The Native American Burdach, by Joseph Agonito. The Spanish explorer Alvar Nunez Cabeza de Vaca, who spent 5 years as a captive among the Indians of Texas, reported with some amazement the exotic conduct of some Indian men. "During the time that I was thus among these people, I saw a devilish thing, and it is that I saw the man married, one man married to another, and these are impotent, effeminate men, and they go about dressed as women and do women's tasks." DeVaca's account is one of the earliest to describe the Native American Burdach, as they came to be called by the Europeans. Burdach, which was originally a French term, though spelled B-A-R-D-A-C-H-E, and changed by anthropologists only in the late 19th century, continued to fascinate and repel successive European explorers, trappers, traders, missionaries, settlers, doctors, and anthropologists. With few exceptions, the Europeans, blinded by their own culture and religion, continued to denounce as immoral a way of life they never fully understood. The Burdach was more than just a passive homosexual, which is what the term Burdach originally signified, but an ancient, integral, sacred, and respected part of Native American society. The Burdach was usually a male, less frequently female. They were anatomically normal, but for deeply personal and religious reasons, assumed the dress, occupation, manner, and sexual behavior of the opposite sex, affecting a change in gender status. Burdaches, when dressed as the opposite sex, cut a striking appearance. George Catlin, the 19th century painter, described the male Burdach among the Mandans. "Such personages may be seen on a pleasant day, strutting and parading around the village in the most beautiful and unsoiled dresses. They plume themselves with swan's down and quills of ducks, with braids and plaits of sweet-scented grass." Catlin began to paint one of the Burdaches, but unfortunately stopped when some of the chiefs protested that the individual was not a worthy subject. Wiwa, the famous Zuni Lamana, the Zuni word for Burdach, so completely dressed and looked like a woman that for years the anthropologist Matilda Cox Stevenson did not know that Wiwa was a man. Wiwa spent 6 months visiting Washington, D.C., using women's bathrooms without ever being detected. Osh Tish, a leader among the Crow Bade, as Burdaches were called among the Crow, always dressed like a woman except on one occasion. That one time he dressed like a man to fight against the Sioux at the Battle of the Rosebud, June 17, 1876, where he got his special name, finds them and kills them. Robert H. Lowy, an Ento historian who met Osh Tish in 1907, said that the Bidet who was nearly 50 years old, was 5'7" tall, and would have completely passed for a woman except for his affectedly piping voice. Pagan women, a Blackfoot Berdash, wore a woman's dress, combed his hair in feminine style, and was fond of jewelry. Female Berdaches usually assumed male dress. Khan Nagon, the most famous female Berdash among the Kutina, wore men's shirts, leggings, and breed cloth. Tall and large-boned, she passed for a man. Cross-dressing, though, was neither universally practiced nor fixed among the Berdaches. Some blended male and female items. Justine, whose Kutani name meant acts like a woman, wore a woman's dress with masculine-type leggings. A Kwaktui chief described a Berdach who wore women's earrings, brooches, and rings, but dressed in pants. Kia at Navajo dressed sometimes as a woman and sometimes as a man. Others simply refused to wear the opposite sex's clothing. Woman Chief was a famous Crow heroine who distinguished herself as a hunter, warrior, and chief. Disdaining women's work, Woman Chief took herself four wives. Still, she always dressed like a woman. Berdaches did more than cross-dress. They tried to take on the mannerisms of the opposite sex. Elsie Clues Parsons, the anthropologist, described the conduct of Laspiki, a 6-year-old Zuni boy with unusually fine and delicate features who already showed signs of becoming Alamana. He talked like a girl, using the expressions, the exclamations, and the turns of speech of a girl. Alexander Henry, the fur trader, recorded in his diary a revealing description of an Ojibwa Berdach. This person is a curious compound between a man and a woman. He is a man both to his members and courage, but pretends to be womanish and dresses as such. His walk and mode of sitting, his manners, occupations, and language are those of a woman. Justine, the Kutenai Berdash, though a large, heavy-set person with a deep voice, tried nonetheless to imitate a woman's way of speaking. He also sat with both legs turned to one side, as did the women. Berdaches performed the occupations of the gender whose dress they assumed. Men were exceptionally skilled in women's work, and in some tribes, Winnebago, Crow, Assiniboine, Lakota, they excelled women in their own work. The male Berdaches were good and hard workers, well noted for their cooking, tanning, quilling, weaving, and beadwork. The Crow Bidé, for instance, who lived as a group in their own camp circle, were famous for having the largest and best decorated teepees in the tribe. The male Berdaches provided well for their families. Women who lived in such households were especially pleased, since the male Berdaches, given their physical strength, would do double the work of the women, who often left domestic chores to bear and raise children. Wiwa and Zuni Lamana, one of the tallest and strongest members of the tribe, assumed the hardest household chores. He would not permit idleness from other members of the family, and anyone who did so was severely reprimanded. A Papago woman expressed her pleasure with the woman man Shining Evening, who was very pleasant, always laughing and talking, and a good worker. She, the Papago referred to the male Berdash as a she, was so strong she did not get tired grinding corn as I did, so sometimes she did it for me. I found the man-woman very convenient. The Navajo prized the natal, which was their word for a Berdash. Kinipe, a natal, was an excellent potter, expressed the sentiments of many Navajo when he said, "A family that has a natal born into it will be brought riches and success." The natal, who preferred male and female activities, were extremely productive. They knit, tanned hides, made moccasins, raised sheep, and excelled as weavers, potters, and basket makers. important crafts which added to the wealth of the family. They acted as head of the family, supervising the work of family members in the home and fields, and controlling and disposing of all property. It is no wonder that a Navajo told W.W. Hill, the enthrographer, that they, the Natal, are responsible for all wealth in the country. If there were no more left, the horses, sheep, and Navajo would all go. Female Berdaches were as outstanding in their performance of men's work. The Kootenai Berdache Kangon provided for many wives by hunting, raiding, and warfare, and by serving as a courier, guide, and translator for fur traders. Sahawiza, a Mojave Huami, a female Berdache, took good care of her wives. She assumed all the men's chores in the relationship, worked hard in the fields, and took great pleasure in dressing her wives with pretty clothes and beads. The famous Crow Woman chief, tall and strong, excelled in all man's activities. She was a fearless rider, a prodigious hunter, a daring raider, a bold warrior, who counted coup and a chief, ranking third in a band of 160 lodges. Such was her standing and wealth among the Crows that she needed four wives to keep her lodge. Homosexuality was an integral part of their Berdache lifestyle, though even here there were some variations. There are scattered accounts in the literature of some Berdaches who were either asexual or bisexual, but these are clearly exceptional cases, for the Berdaches were, by nature, erotically attached to their own sex. Male Berdaches generally assumed the more passive role in the sex act, whereas female Berdaches played the more dominant role of men in lovemaking. From the Native American perspective, however, the sexual relationship of the Berdache, at least in a social sense, not homosexual in the European meaning of the term. Berdaches considered themselves as members of the gender they assumed, and this was generally accepted by members of the tribe. Hence, a male Berdache who assumed the female role was viewed by all as the woman in the relationship with the male partner. A Berdache never had sex with another Berdache, but only with normal members of their own sex. Male Berdaches, for instance, recognized that they belonged to a sisterhood. The Crow Bidet lived in their own circle within the camp and called each other sister. Cheyenne, half man, half woman, belonged to their own family group. Sexual relations between Berdaches then would have been like incest. The spouse of a Berdache was not considered a homosexual. An individual could have casual sex with a Berdache or live in a long-term relationship and still not be considered a homosexual. Such individuals could leave the relationship at any time and resume a normal life with members of the opposite sex. Kuwai, a Mojave, who had married an Alaya, a male Berdache, eventually left to marry a woman who bore him a child. And the ethnographer, Leslie Spire, met an old man named Ticho Mox, who had once lived with the Klamath male Berdache, White Sydney, but who left to marry a woman and raise his own family. Berdaches were not usually courted in the traditional way. Among the Mojaves, the Alia were approached as gatherings like widows, divorcees, or prostitutes. The Huayme got their female partners by flirting at dances or by visiting girls and married women during the day. There were, of course, exceptions. Woman chief followed the Crow's usual custom in courting and marrying her first wife. She presented horses to the parents of her spouse. Many Berdaches engaged in casual promiscuity, either out of personal preference or tribal pressure against long-term unions. Catlin's description of the sack and fox, dance to the Berdache, in which young men pay their homage to the Berdache with whom they slept, captures the promiscuous side of Berdache sexuality. The Santee Sioux and Lakota tribes permitted young or married men to engage in sexual relations with Berdaches without any guilt or shame, but discouraged long-term relationships lest they endanger the population and life of the tribe. The Lakota, Crow, and Mojave teased the spouses of Berdaches, sometimes to extremes, as a way of discouraging such long-time unions. Berdaches were seldom teased because they were, after all, living according to their true nature. Some tribes sanctioned marriage with Berdaches, but usually attached certain conditions. The Lakota accepted the Wangti, the name for the Berdash, which meant a would-be woman, only as a secondary spouse, whom a man would marry only after he had a female wife and children. Herdasta Berdashes usually married older men who were without children and were having trouble keeping their females' wives. Among the Herdasta, such unions often led to the formation of complete families, as the Berdash assumed a motherly role by adopting either village orphans or war captives. Marriage with a Berdash offered many of the same advantages as in more traditional heterosexual unions. The Alya, the male Berdash, made exceptionally industrious wives, and many a Mojave man set up house with an Alya rather than a less fastidious young girl for the sake of a well-kept home and good food. Besides, the Alya proved to be more faithful partners than Mojave women, known for their promiscuity. The Alya went so far as faking menstruation and pregnancy, the imaginary child, of course, always being born dead, compelling the husband to observe the customary taboos. The Mojave Huayme, the female Berdash, were also excellent providers and satisfying lovers. The Huayme Sahaquiza, for example, provided well for the sexual and economic needs of her wives. Some Mojave women preferred life with an industrious Huayme rather than a bad marriage with a lazy, flighty man. The Huayme, of course, did not observe their own menses. Some, like Sahaquiza, denied that they menstruated, but observed instead the customs of the husband when their wives menstruated or became pregnant. How did one become a Berdash? Native Americans recognized that the Berdashes were either following their true nature, often manifested in early childhood, or obeying the higher call that came from a transforming dream or vision. There were some exceptional cases where parents actually groomed one of their children for a Berdash's life. Luisino and Kadiak parents might raise one of their boys as a girl and then marry him off at an early age to a wealthy chief. Cusca couples who wanted a daughter to become a hunter raised the child as a boy. The predisposition towards the opposite sex's life often revealed itself in early childhood. Das, a Pomo Berdash, started to act and dress like a girl at age 5 or 6. Laspiki and the Zuna Lamana began to speak like the girls he played with by the age of 6. Mojave, Kokopa, and Ingalik young girls, at a very early age, began to shun girls' dresses and chores, preferring instead to play and act like the boys. In some cultures, particularly among the Mojave and the Papago, the parents of such children would require a formal test to determine if the child were destined for the life of the Berdash. Shining Evening, the Papago man-woman, was so tested as a young boy. His parents placed him in a little enclosure containing a bow and arrow and some basketry materials. They then set fire to the back of the enclosure. Shining Evening came running out carrying the basketry materials. They tested him again and again, and each time the result was the same. Shining Evening was meant to be a Berdash. In one unique case, the test had very different results. As a young woman, Lalix, a Klamath Indian, was already wearing a woman's dress and performing women's chores. One day as she lay down to sleep, some friends placed a bow and arrows and a punt pole, a woman's symbol, by her side. They shouted, and as Lakeeks jumped up, he grasped the bow. From that day, he left off women's ways and dress. Lalix became a famous chief of the Klamath with seven wives. Some ethno-historians have argued that young boys often became berdashes in order to avoid the life of the warrior. There is simply no correlation between the existence of berdashism and warfare. Berdashes could often be found among the peaceful Zuni and Hopi, as well as among the more aggressive Northern Plains tribes. The warlike Comanches and Iroquois had no berdashes at all. Actually, many berdashes fought with distinction as warriors in battle. Besides Osh Tish, the Crow Bidet, who fought with bravery against the Sioux at the Battle of the Rosebud, there were Piegan Woman, the Blackfoot Berdash, who went on his first raiding party at the age of 15 and continued to do so for the rest of his life. Four Bears, a great Hidasta warrior, once attacked three women on the prairie. One of the women was a Berdash, who, armed only with a digging stick, struck back, saying, "You can't kill me, for I am holy." When Four Bears' arrow would not penetrate the Berdash's robe, he called off the raid because of the Berdash's great supernatural power. Occasionally established warriors embraced the Berdash lifestyle. Victor Tixier, a 19th century traveler, reported the case of La Berdash, a brave Osage warrior who suddenly gave up fighting to become a Berdash. John Treat Irving, a fellow 19th century traveler, recorded a startling transformation among the Otoes. After returning from a warring expedition, one of the most distinguished braves suddenly announced to the tribe that the Great Spirit had commanded him in a dream to give up the life of the warrior. He then destroyed his weapons and took his place with the women, assuming their dress and vocation. Young boys then did not become berdashes simply to escape from the role of warrior. They did so to be true to their real nature or to their dreams or visions. The predisposition of an individual to the opposite sex's life was usually reinforced and validated by a dream or vision, which was considered by Native Americans sacred and irresistible. Such supernatural revelations could occur at any time in a person's life. The Mojave believed that a foetus in the sixth month was conscious and capable of dreaming about its future destiny, so that if it dreamed about becoming a Berdash, it would become one. Among the Yuma, such dreams often came at puberty, thereby sanctioning the young person's decision to live the life of the opposite sex. One young Yuma boy experienced such a transforming dream. When he got out of the dream, he put his hand to his mouth and laughed four times. He laughed with a woman's voice, and his mind was changed from male into female. Other young people noticed this and began to feel towards him as to a woman. Often such dreams came unexpectedly to an adult. Father Pierre de Smet, the 19th century missionary, recorded the story of a snake woman who dreamed that she was a man. When she awoke, the woman dressed like a man, engaged in hunting and war, and became a brave or a chief. Some men were transformed into berdashes by visions which usually involved female deities, of which the most widespread among the Prairie and Great Plains tribes was the moon. In the Omaha account, which is the most complete, the moon appears to a man carrying in one hand a burden strap and in the other a bow and arrows. The dreamer would have to choose between them. When he reached for the bow, the moon would cross his hands and try to force the burden strap on him. If the man took the burden strap, his status as a berdash was sealed. One man who tried to go against the vision and failed resorted to suicide as the only means to escape. Some cultures had an initiation ceremony to mark the berdash's rite of passage. Yuma parents gave a public feast and invited guests who were served food prepared by their Badash son. The Mojave initiation ceremony was both a test and a confirmation of Badash status. One version of the public ceremony called for the young boy to be placed in a circle before the assembled crowd. A singer began to sing the sacred Alya songs, and the young boy, if he was inclined to the lifestyle of the Alya, would dance to the songs. The women then took the young boy down to the river, washed him, gave him a skirt, and led him back to the crowd dressed as an Alya. Young girls went through the same ceremony. Native American language and thought does not lead itself, at least in a European sense, a precise definition of the Berdash's gender status. Berdashism was not a complete shift from one sex to the other, but a profound, though incomplete, movement towards the assumed sex. By and large, the male Berdash was like a woman, but not a woman. The female Berdash was like a man, but not a man. When Papago men teasingly asked the women how the Berdash, shining evening, behaved, they said, "Just like a woman. We have forgotten he is a man." Berdaches preferred to be recognized and addressed in terms common to the sex they assumed, and Native Americans responded accordingly. Crow and Lakota Berdaches referred to themselves as sisters. The Zuni referred to the Lamana Wiwa as a she. Among the Navajo, the blood payment for the murder of a male Berdash is the same as that for a woman, which is higher than the payment for a man. The Ingleslick female Berdash takes her bath at the Kashim with the men, and they pretend not to recognize her true sex. Yet Native Americans recognized that the Berdash could not completely cross over to the other sex. After all, no matter how well a male Berdash imitated a woman, he lacked a woman's reproductive capability, and a female Berdash could not impregnate a woman. The Mojave ridiculed the Alas and Huami for pretending that they had transcended that anatomical sex. Quignon's brother, who saw his sister naked in the water, openly rejected her claim that her sex had been physically transformed. Native American culture recognized the androgynous nature of the Berdash. Clawed Woman, a Cree Berdash, realized this when she wanted to be called Thunder Woman, a name that combined male and female terms. Interestingly, the Cree claimed that Thunder Woman died because he had worn out the dress of a woman who had menstruated, and he had been killed by the power of her menstrual blood, as any man would have been. When the Zuni buried their Lamana, they placed trousers under the dress and placed the corpse in the man's part of the cemetery. John Lane Deer, a Lakota holy man, asked a contemporary would-be woman what he would be in the spirit land, and he replied, "A man and a woman." With rare exceptions, Native American tribes in the old days viewed the Berdashes with respect and reverence. The Mojave believed that from the beginning of the world, the god Matavzli created the Alyi and the Huami. Zuni and Navajo creation stories stress the prominent role played by the Berdash. From a Native American perspective, the Berdashes, androgynous in nature, were supernaturally endowed persons who received their special character from spiritual forces. The Lakota considered the Winkti as Waken, a sacred person. The Hidasta treated the Berdash as mysterious and holy. Possessing spiritual powers, the Berdash performed sacred functions. Hidasta and Crow Berdashes located and chopped down the special tree for the sun dance. Wiwa, the Zuni Lamana, was always called by his clan or family to recite a long prayer or offer grace at a feast. Lakota Winktis bestowed secret names on young boys or girls, which magically protected them from harm and assured them a long life. Sitting Bull, Black Elk, and Crazy Horse had secret winkty names. Given their special connection to the spirit world, Berdashes made good shaman, curing body and mind from sickness. Thunder Woman, the Cree Berdash, was noted as a great healer. Kimpai, the Navajo Nidal, knew the chants for cursing insanity resulting from incest and from curing body sores. Sahawiska, the Mojave Huami, specialized in the cure of venereal diseases. Cheyenne war parties seldom started without a Berdash, who, in addition to being gifted doctors, provided graceful, entertaining company for the warriors. Berdashes then were productive members of their families and society, performing many useful social, economic, and religious functions. One Navajo informant captured the significant worth of the natal when he said, "They know everything. They can do both the work of a man and a woman. I think when all the natal are gone, that will be the end of the Navajo." As Native Americans in the late 19th century came under the influence of white Americans, some began to lose respect for the Berdash. White Americans belittled the Berdashes and constantly sought to change their ways. United States government agents in the 1870s tried to force a Hidasta Berdash to wear men's clothing, but he fled to a Crow reservation for sanctuary. He may have found shelter on the Crow reservation, for when the agent there tried to force Osh Tish to wear men's clothing, the Crows protested, saying that it was against his nature. Canadian police followed Francis, the Kwatuli Berdash, to cut his hair and wear men's clothes. Francis changed after that, and Charlie, his lover, lamented that Francis was no more my sweetheart. Christian missionaries denounced Berdashes as immoral. A Baptist minister on the Crow Reservation condemned the bidet and encouraged his congregation to avoid Osh Tish. Christian ministries among the Lakota would not permit winkties to be buried in the Christian cemeteries. Some Christian Indians turned against the Berdashes. Under the influence of Catholicism, some Kootenai tried to persuade the Berdash Justine to stop living with the women. The hostility and intolerance which Berdashes experienced from agents, missionaries, and Charlotte Christian Indians led some to despair and suicide. Despite the changing and hostile climate of opinion, the Berdash tradition survives, though with some modifications. Traditional Indians continue to view the Berdash as natural and holy and protect them from less sympathetic whites and acculturated Indians. John Lame Deer, the contemporary Lakota holy man, says of the Winkti, "To us, a man is what nature or his dreams makes him. We accept him for what he wants to be." There may have been changes. Some homosexually inclined Indians, influenced by the urban gay scene, do not want to be considered half men, half women. They want to be seen as men loving other gay men. Some, like the Lakota Michael One Feather, can cross over into both worlds. He can identify with urban gays and yet still take on the old spiritual quality of the Winkti. Finally, there are some, like the widely respected Lakota Winkti, Terry Calling Eagle, who continue today in the best tradition of the Berdash, androgynous in character, deeply spiritual, loving men, providing a good home for orphan children, and caring for his family and people. Terry Calling Eagle is part of a long and sacred and honorable tradition among the Native Americans. True West Magazine, Archives, March 1989 edition. Bruce Younger, The Man, the Myth, the Mummy, by Marley Brandt. Sometime in 1891, an interesting item appeared in the Clinton, Missouri Democrat. The story told how a group of miners in New Mexico passed the night in a cave. On coming out in the morning, they saw something odd in the opening. It appeared to be a body. Hesitantly approaching it, the miners discovered that it was most certainly a human corpse. Upon closer examination, the men determined that it was not just any old corpse, but rather a mummified body. The newspaper account goes on to identify the former occupant of the body rather routinely, but such a task would not necessarily have been easy. Surely in those times there must have been dozens of adventurers of one sort or another missing in the wilds of New Mexico. How his body came to be identified as that of Bruce Younger, an uncle of the Missouri Outlaws, and how Bruce's final destination came to be a cave in the Guadalupe Mountains in southern New Mexico makes for an interesting tale. Who was Bruce Younger, the inhabitant of the mummified body? Uncle to the Younger brothers, by virtue of being their father, Henry's half-brother, Bruce was born Bruce Wilson in Ocala, Missouri in 1853. Henry and Bruce's father, Charles Lee Younger, was originally from Virginia and Kentucky. Upon his arrival in Missouri, Charles began to establish quite a presence. He had two wives and two mistresses who bore him a total of 19 children. Henry Younger's mother was Charles's wife, Sarah Purcell, of the genteel and cultured Sullivan and Purcell families of the Southeast. Bruce's mother was Charles's mistress, Parmela Wilson of the Shenandoah Valley. Although his legitimate offspring may have been more respected, his sons and daughters by Pamela were by no means shunned. The Wilsons were allowed to change their names to Younger by virtue of Charles's last will and testament of 1854. Eventually, these children included a businessman, two teachers, wives, farmers' wives, and a Missouri state legislator. Bruce's sister, Adeline Lee, was the mother of the outlaw Dalton brothers. The Wilson Youngers were as welcomed in the community of St. Clair County, Missouri, as Charles's other children. Charles Younger died when Bruce was less than a year old, so it is hard to say what influence the father would have had on the son. Most of Bruce's early years were spent in the household of his sister, Sophia Reagan. Sophia's husband, Tillard, was quite active in local politics in both St. Clair and Cass counties. Tillard had many friends and an abundance of influential associates. The Reagans were considered an active part of the local established society. By the time he was 17 in 1870, Bruce had followed the example of his brothers Henry and Frank, pre-Civil War owners of large livery business in Harrisonville, and bought some fine horses. In a very short time, Bruce became known as one of the area's most honest and reliable horse traders. He eventually became partners with Drew Garrett from the Lee's Summit area of Jackson County, and the stellar reputation of their business spread. Bruce and Drew became co-venturers in breeding and selling horses throughout some of the southern states as well as Missouri. One wonders how Bruce dealt with his last name. It seems likely he would associate himself with the more respected and influential members of the Younger family. On the other hand, there was great respect for the Younger brothers among those still fighting the war, and they had many friends. Possibly the latter element constituted the majority of Bruce's customers. Perhaps it was a combination of both. Regardless, his horse trading business was quite successful, and Bruce and Drew were able to realize sizable profits. By no means did Bruce feel ashamed of his nephews, nor did he shy away from any association with them. He and his nephew, Bob Younger, were nearly the same age. Although Bob had lived in homes all over Missouri during and after the Civil War, he was quite close to Bruce when they found themselves in the same St. Clair County location throughout their adolescence. When Bruce started his horse business, one of his first sales was to Bob and Jim Younger, who were from Denison, Texas, operating a cattle business with their brothers Cole and John. When John Younger left Texas after he was accused of murder in 1872, he traveled to California to stay with Bruce's brother, TJ. When John returned home to Missouri a short time later, he stayed in the area of Mauganaw Springs, Bruce's hometown. Bruce probably was one of the first relatives to identify the body of John Younger after he was killed during a gun battle with Pinkerton detectives near Mauganaw on March 17, 1874. It has never been proved, nor is it likely, that Bruce ever participated in any robberies with the Younger brothers. At the time the Younger brothers were most active in their outlaw activities, Bruce was involved in legitimate horse trading and selling. In 1874, things suddenly started to change with Bruce. That year, he became uncharacteristically interested in horse racing. His father had been known in his earlier years for his great interest in racing horses and his more than occasional involvement with the actual races. A story circulates among the Younger family, even today, that once Charles was watching his young son, Richard, ride one of his prize horses in a very important race. The horse stumbled, throwing and trampling the boy. The tale continues that Charles lifted his dead son's body out of the way, replaced him with another rider, and his horse went on to win the race. Younger researchers, however, have never been able to document the existence of this son and are extremely skeptical of the stories having any basis in fact. If Bruce's horse racing adventures started on the up and up, it is not likely that they stayed that way. Bruce started to spend considerable time at horse races all over the country in the company of his sister's husband, Lewis Dalton. Lewis was well known for his interest in racehorses as well as his gambling, and he managed to keep himself active on the horse racing circuit for quite some time. Dalton had little to do with the upbringing of his children, and one can't help but wonder how his lifestyle influenced his sons, Bill, Grot, Bob, and Emmett, the future outlaws. Bruce became more and more involved with the seedy side of the horse racing business, and his ties with Drew Garrett and his younger relatives in Missouri became strained. He started gambling quite a bit himself and often lost large amounts of money. By 1876, Bruce was involved with what might be termed the outlaw elements of the horse business. Relatives thought that Bruce should be encouraged to turn his life around, as he was a very bright, popular, and well-bred young man. Perhaps he entertained the suggestion this time, but he may have been in over his head and too proud to ask for the help of his family. Then in September 1876, the Younger brothers were sentenced to life in the Stillwater Penitentiary for their attempted robbery of the First National Bank of Minnesota at Northfield. Bruce's sisters claimed that he was completely devastated by this event. His younger nephews were, after all, like brothers to him. The final defeat of the younger boys stigmatized their family. This turn of events, along with Bruce's depression over his own life, caused him to head west to Kansas. By 1877, he was steeped in the wild life of the frontier town of Galena, Kansas. Sometime during 1878, Bruce started a relationship with outlaw supporter Belle Shirley Reed, who would later gain notoriety as Belle Starr. Bruce and Belle were seen in each other's company for the next 2 years, and documents revealed that both were in Labette County, Kansas, in May of 1880. Bruce probably knew who Belle Shirley was from many years before Missouri, but this association in Kansas was likely their first. In February 1888, Belle Starr's greatest granddaughter, Flossie Mae Wiley of Colorado, found an interesting document in her family's possession. It appeared to be a marriage certificate issued to Bruce Younger and Maybelle Reed. Star researcher Philip W. Steele brought forth the document, a copy, and it appears that the marriage did indeed take place at Chautauqua, Labette County, Kansas, on May 15, 1880. The marriage was performed by John P. Shields. S.L. Coulter was the probate judge authorizing the union. While Bell and Bruce were married in May of 1880, Bell appears to have married Sam Starr only 20 days later, on June 5th, 1880. Pioneer justice being what it was in those days, it is possible that Bruce and Bell were granted a divorce in time for her marriage to Sam Starr to have been legal. One can only speculate, however, why Bruce and Bell parted company after so short a time, and if Bell's marriage to Sam Starr was, after all, legal. It is unlikely that Pearl Reed, who is sometimes called Pearl Younger, was Bruce's daughter. It is often claimed that Pearl Younger's father was Cole Younger. Since Cole denied many times over that this could be possible and claimed that his relationship with Belle Shirley was platonic and started only after she was Mrs. Jim Reed, it is most likely that Pearl was, as the family of Belle Starr claims, Jim Reed's daughter. It was no secret that Belle was infatuated with Cole since he had been a gorilla with Quantrill, and that might have been the reason she associated with Bruce in the first place. While many think that Younger's Bend was certainly named after Cole, there exists the possibility that Belle had named it after Bruce. Whatever the extent of their relationship, Belle and Bruce had parted company by June 1881. Belle had, after all, married Sam Starr by that time. Bruce reappeared in Missouri in June 1881. He wrote a letter to the Liberty, Missouri Tribune, reporting that he had seen Jesse James in St. Clair County. The sighting of James in that part of the state seems unusual. While Jesse was known to go down there often from his Clay County home to visit with the Youngers, it is assumed that his relationship with the Younger family had been broken after the Northfield fiasco. What then was Bruce's purpose for making such a report? Since no one has yet proven what really happened when the Jameses and the Youngers parted company after Northfield, Bruce's actions add to the speculation. Was he, out of loyalty to his nephews, telling authorities where they might find Jesse? Or was he, out of loyalty to his nephew's friends, throwing the authorities off Jesse's trail by reporting erroneous information? According to Bruce's daughter, Sophia, during 1882, Bruce's depression worsened. She was never certain why, but she felt that it had to do in large part with the way his life seemed to be turning out. Bruce felt persecuted by authorities who had been insinuating he may have been involved with the Younger brothers' robberies. Some even went so far as to say that since he was so close in age and appearance to Bob Younger, he may have served as Bob's stand-in. Whether correctly or incorrectly, Bruce felt his reputation was being sullied. And the speculation and gossip brought around the holders of some of his gambling debts. Also, the Stars may not have been friendly toward him at this time, and he may not have wanted them to know where he was. Regardless of what inspired him to go, Bruce took off for the mountains of New Mexico to put some space between himself and his problems. He had no desire to bring the criminal or unsavory elements of his lifestyle to his family's home in St. Clair County. All agreed it was the best thing for him to do. Bruce Younger never returned home. After his body was found, a story circulated in the newspapers that Bruce had been hiding in that Guadalupe Mountain cave for a number of years. The stories even went so far as to say that his family had known he was in the cave and occasionally visited him there. Elaborating on that, the Clinton Democrat reported that one of the Younger servants, a former slave, regularly brought him food and ammunition so that he would never have to leave the cave. The papers, however, never speculated why he would not have wanted to leave the cave. They likely assumed that because he was a Younger and was hiding out, he was an outlaw of some description. Anyway, the story is most unlikely. Sophia Reagan and her sister, identified Bruce's body after they read the initial report about a man being found in a cave in New Mexico. Sophia claimed that she knew her brother had been in New Mexico. She had been trying to locate him since he was last seen by a mutual friend who had never returned to Missouri to be questioned about Bruce's whereabouts. After Bruce's mummified body had been identified by his family, one newspaper claims that he was sent to Denison, Texas. From there, it was to be delivered to the museum in Boston. Which museum that might have been has not been determined, nor has the final destination of the body. It is disheartening to think that a successful young man from an established pioneer family of some name could end up an unidentified mummy in the lonely hills of New Mexico. The search for the final resting place of Bruce Younger, uncle, businessman, gambler, continues.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.